I'm Perry Marshall. I think most of you are here because you're on my Cosmic Fingerprints email list, and probably, you know, a few friends and stuff, but we're going to have a really interesting presentation today. One of the reasons that I wanted to do this is because I'm working on a book, which is, you know, probably 80% done at this point, and I wanted to take the most important content in the book and present it to you guys and get like a live human being's reaction to this and see what kind of questions come up. And it works out really well because I have Richard Morgan here, and Richard is helping me edit the book, and he's here from France. He got in last night. He's a British guy who's lived in France for, what, 27 years? And he brings a really unique perspective to this because he was a card-carrying, blind watchmaker-thumping atheist for 25 years and had a very interesting conversion experience. Because of that, he has this perspective about what, you know, secular people, how secular people see things that I think is immensely valuable. And so, so we're both just paying a lot of attention to what questions get asked and what are you guys curious about and what works for you and what doesn't. And, so I'm going to talk for about an hour. I'll do a little bit of Q&A. And then Richard will talk, and then we'll just open it up for, you know, if people want to stay around and ask questions and discuss, then I'm delighted to have you here doing that. So welcome. Glad you're here. Absolutely. Have a seat. No problem. No problem. So I'm glad you're here. So let's just get right into it. About 7 years ago, I got pulled into the whole creation evolution debate, design evolution debate, because my brother had gone from being a hardcore devout Christian to within spitting distance of being an atheist, and within a space of a couple of years, and he's a really intensely smart guy. He asks deeper questions than what most people ask, and he was asking a lot of questions, and I didn't know the answers to them, and it was really pushing my buttons, and I didn't really realize it until this happened, but what I discovered was that probably my strongest intuitions about God and spirituality really came from my sense of science and the order of the physical world. That when push come to shove, that for me, everybody's different. I mean, we know people that are, you know, they're not really into science or anything like that, and maybe for them it's like music or something, right? But for me, I was an electrical engineer. Electrical engineer sees the world through a certain set of lenses. And those lenses said, well, there's something very, very ingenious about this universe we live in. And Brian did a very successful job of challenging all of that. He's like, no, evolution through random variation and natural selection is all you need. And he was adamant on that. I'm like, really? I don't know. So I'm going to find out. Well, you know, however this shakes out, I'm going to find out. You know what? If the facts end up telling me that there's no need for God or whatever, then I'm willing to revise my views about spiritual things to get to the truth. Let's find out what the truth is. So it was very scary. It was like, okay, let's see where this takes us. So I begin on this journey. And so I'm gonna give you just a little bit of the first part of that journey. But most of my talk today is going to be how the rabbit hole went deeper, 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 even after I came to some initial conclusions. And so let's just get right into it. You've come to the right place if, number one, you are a person, let's say that you believe in design, or you believe in creationism, or you know, if you have that view, but you're open to examining evidence that evolution might be true, you're in the right place. Okay, now, if you're not open to that kind of evidence, then this is just entertainment. Okay, but you're really in the right place if you're open to examining that kind of evidence. You're also in the right place if you're a hardcore Darwinist who's open to the possibility that there might be some kind of design in the universe. If you're open to looking at that kind of evidence, you are also in the right place. Okay? So here's what we're going to do today. I'm going to demonstrate that to the extent that science can prove anything, science proves God exists. I realize that's a rather audacious statement, but I'm going to do that. I'm going to show you that design is a necessary assumption in biology. It's necessary to practice science successfully. I'm going to demonstrate to you that evolution is real and it is not a hoax. I know there are a lot of people that think it is, and there's a lot of literature like fraud, fraud, fraud. I'm going to show that evolution is also a just unbelievably, brilliantly engineered process. It's engineered so well that maybe only an engineer could really appreciate it. So you know, those of you who are geeks, I maybe you'll enjoy this.
Can I ask a question early on?
If it's really quick.
Yeah. What kind of evolution are we talking about? Are we talking about a macro or micro level?
Macro. I'm going to make a case for common descent. I'm going to make a case.
The dinosaur kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, should be interesting. Okay. I would like to propose to you and demonstrate, at least to some extent, that the answers to our biggest medical and technological questions are buried in the secrets of the cell and the genome. That there's all kinds of problems that Microsoft and Hewlett-Packard and Cisco and Google are trying to solve, and really all they need to do to solve those problems is study the cell. I would like to show you today that science and faith are not enemies but allies, and I would like to show you that atheism is not just unscientific, but it's actually anti-scientific. So, that's a rather bold set of claims for 1 hour, but let's go for it. So, I want to show you something that is really fundamental to the whole thing. And so let me explain like biology 101, genetics 101. You know, we have strands of DNA and they have these rungs in them, and we label the rungs A, C, G, T. Where it's just four different chemical bases. And every cell in your body has a strand of DNA in it, and every one of those cells, the strand of DNA, has the same amount of data as a CD-ROM. And that CD-ROM contains all the information necessary to build you. Now, for a little bit of perspective, you know, CD-ROM is 750 megabytes, all right? Now, in my computer at home, I got a Windows computer, and the Windows directory takes 22 gigabytes, not 750 megabytes. So Windows Vista takes, I don't know, 30 times as much space as the plans for a human body, okay? Now, Would all of you agree that the human body is a superior engineering achievement to Windows Vista? No, I don't get any disagreement from that. Oh, my arm crashed. Oh, reboot. Right? Think about the fact that all of the code it takes to build everything in your body is packed on that CD-ROM. Okay? The data compression is unbelievable. Well, that data is arranged in groups of three that are called triplets. And what happens when a cell divides? It makes a copy. And then the cell that's being built, it reads this data off of the CD-ROM. And what happens is this DNA strand divides in half, and one half goes this way, and one half goes this way, and one half of it is then split off to form another strand called messenger RNA, where the A's become A's, the C's become C's, the G's become G's, and the T's become U's, which is uracil. And the messenger RNA, so this is called messenger RNA, and the messenger RNA then is read by it's called a ribosome, but you can almost think of it like the head of a hard drive. Okay? It's read by a ribosome, and it takes these as instructions, and the instructions tell the ribosome to assemble amino acids. Okay? So we have a four-letter digital code that leads to a 64-character alphabet. Four-letter code to a 64-character alphabet, which leads to a family of 20 amino acids, which are then strung together in complex three-dimensional shapes to make proteins. Proteins are made out of amino acids. Yes, sir?
Real quick, is each letter equivalent to a data bit in your CD-ROM?
Yes. So, and that's my... So I've just given you this really basic idea of how DNA gets turned into amino acids, which then get turned into proteins, which are assembled in all of the right places and in the right order to build a cell, to build a human body. Okay? Now, what I want to focus on is what you just asked here, which is, so we have a four-letter code, which is represented by these little bases, which is translated to a 64-letter alphabet, which is groups of three, which is then turned into 20 amino acids. So this is essentially identical to, let me just make a little space here. Let's say that I press a letter A on my keyboard. So now I'm going to talk about computers for a second. So here's a computer world. Okay? I press a letter A on my keyboard. Now, if my keyboard has a wire that goes to the computer, the keyboard turns the A into something called ASCII. And ASCII is, A is 1000001, and it goes to your computer, and on the screen, you see an A. Right? And so, these are bits, and the bits are organized in bytes. And ASCII is 7, and a byte is 8. and like this is computer 101, right? So, here's the thing. We encode the A as a message and we decode the A as a little dots on your screen, right? And that's how a computer works. In DNA, we encode the data as messenger RNA and we decode it into amino acids. It's the exact same concept. There is no difference conceptually.
That's why it's known as the biocomputer, the mind in a way.
Right.
It's just
right. Bioinformatics is the application of ideas from computer science to biology. Okay? Now, this was when biology began to make sense to me. So, I'm having these arguments with my brother, and I'm really not sure. And I'm like, well, maybe this is going to turn me into an atheist. Wherever this goes. Buy all these stacks of books. I'm trying to sift through this. Combing the web. How many of you have, like, surf the web for hours and hours trying to make sense of like all this stuff, right? And I'm just I'm drowning in confusion and complexity and all these people arguing with each other and I can't figure out which way is up. And I finally, when I figure this out, oh, okay. Now I've got like something I can stand on. A few years before, I had written this book. It's called Industrial Ethernet. It's published by the largest trade organization for process control engineers. It's like guys that do oil refineries and automotive plants and semiconductor fabs. They would read a book like this to figure out how to wire the equipment together. But Ethernet is just the cable that plugs into your computer and gets you on the internet. That's all it is. So all of a sudden, this snapped in place. Okay, DNA is a digital communications system. Got it. Okay, so that means that like all these questions, so neo-Darwinism says that evolution happens when random copying errors of DNA are occasionally beneficial and natural selection picks the good ones. Welcome, glad you're here. Nice to see you again.
Define neo-Darwinism as opposed to classic.
Well, so I'll get to that. I'll get to that. But I realized that I could map all of this into the world of information, and I could figure out, okay, what's true and what's not. Because if a cell starts by basically reading a CD-ROM, then we really have something to go on. So that's how this began to make sense. So here's the thing. If you want to do this, if you want to build a system that, you know, where somebody presses an A and then, you know, a little A appears on the screen and it gets coded, does it make sense that this and this have to be defined first? Does it make sense? We have to define the language before any of this can work. We have to define that, okay, 10001 is capital A, and 100010 is capital B. Okay? We have to have a language first. Well, that's pretty interesting, because that meant that based on everything that we actually know about DNA, the language had to exist before the cell existed. The idea had to exist before the system could be built. It embodies an idea. It infers an idea. So the genetic code is proof of design. Because all coding systems require the code to be designed before the system can be built. Now, if anybody can ever find an exception to this, then they would have grounds for saying that it's not designed. I've never been able to find anybody who could show me an example of a code or a coding system that was not designed. They're all designed. So really, in the world of codes, think of how many codes there are. How many computer languages are there? Thousands, probably, right? How many human languages are there, right? How many little encryption, you know, mechanisms has armies and navies come up with, right? Thousands and thousands. So it's like we have thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of codes, and they're all designed. And we have one, and we don't know where it came from. And that's DNA. Okay, so I got 999,999 codes that are designed, none that aren't, and I got DNA, and I don't know how it got there. Okay, that's what you call scientific inference. If you accept the scientific method, the conclusion that DNA was designed is inevitable. So to make a really long story short, I've been on the internet for probably 7 years challenging people all over the world to come up with an exception, and nobody's ever come up with one. So that's the first little bit of the presentation today, and that gets you to about 5 years ago as far as I'm concerned. Okay? The rest of today, I want to take you to the rest of the journey, because when I came to that conclusion, it did not rule out evolution at all. What it suggested to me that if evolution is true, there's a whole lot more to this story than anybody's telling us. And so I started looking through the literature. And I don't know, what in the world did I do with my nifty little remote control? So I dig deeper and I dig deeper. Well, you know, DNA has genes. No. There's like some little. You know what? It's not worth anybody's trouble. I'll just press the space bar. It'll be okay. As I investigated, there's the little base pairs in DNA, and then there's the codons, the triplets. And then there's genes, which are like, the equivalent in English would be somewhat long words. They're not really long, but, you know, they're like 20 or 30 characters long, typically, or maybe they're 100. And then there's chromosomes. And if DNA is like a set of encyclopedias, a chromosome is like one volume of the encyclopedia. Okay? And I found the structure, and the structure was eerily similar to computer codes. It was eerily similar to TCP/IP, which some of you know what that is, some of you don't, but if somebody said, well, what's your IP address or something like that, that's what TCP/IP is. Basically, you could think of TCP/IP is like the, you know, on railroads they have those flatbed cars, and then you see the shipping containers on the flatbed cars, and they're going back and forth. TCP/IP is like the flatbed cars of the internet. All those video files and all the audio files and all the emails and all the web pages, they get packed on little TCP/IP packets, and they get sent all over the world. And it's the basis of pretty much everything on the internet. And like, wow, DNA and TCP/IP are like almost the same thing. Except DNA's better. Like, it's better. Aditya, welcome. So, I saw the similarity. So, what about evolution? So the first question for me was, well, all right, is evolution valid? Now, there's been a lot of, like, hoaxes and, you know, like, Piltdown Man was fake, and, like, there's all these fossils and things that people made up stuff about. I felt like the digital data tells a much cleaner story about evolution than the fossils do. You know, you look at bones, it's not nearly as good as looking at digital code. Well, one of the things that persuaded me that common descent from a single ancestor and evolutionary might be true is that There's something called pseudogenes, which are slightly corrupted genes that are in human DNA. And some of them are identical to the pseudogenes in chimpanzees. It's sort of like if your professor caught you cheating on a test, he can tell because your wrong answer and your neighbor's wrong answer are identical, right? Well, it's like a copying error in generations of scrolls of the Bible where, oh, well, we can tell this one came from this one came from this one because the scribe in the third century messed up this word, and then all the ones after it have the same messed up word. You have that between primates and humans, where you don't see those other places. So that strongly suggests that there is common descent. Another thing that I think is interesting, there's something called a Hox gene. It's in all mammals. It's even in fruit flies. And the Hox gene is extremely sensitive to corruption. If one letter is wrong, it can be fatal. Okay? And when I say 99% the same, actually, in one sense, it's actually 100% the same. It's just that it can be, when it gets translated, it gets translated correctly. But Hox genes in humans are the same as Hox genes in fruit flies. It's the same little bit of information. And so this to me was persuasive. Now here's another one that I thought was really interesting. This is a whale skeleton. And most people don't know that whales in the back of their body have these little tiny legs and feet. But they're buried in the blubber and you don't see them normally. But all the structure is there. Now, I sit there and I go, okay, if God like beamed whales into the ocean from, you know, from heaven and the ocean, it was like Star Trek, would God make a whale with those little tiny feet in there? Well, I don't have time for that, but I looked at that as an engineer and I said, well, that's really interesting. Like, well, so the genes take those legs and they crunch them up into this, you know, very small set of bones and stuff that takes very little resources, but it's still there. It's like, well, what if it might need that sometime? Maybe the genome is conserving it because it might come in handy. And it looks to me like it used to be there, and there's actually a way to, you know, to twist some clicks on the dial and compress it and keep it there. And so this to me was substantial evidence of common descent. And I said, well, what if I look at evolution as an engineering process? This is actually quite remarkable from an engineer's point of view. Which would be more remarkable? Let's say that Bill Gates and his friends had written DOS in 1981. Y'all know DOS, right? Y'all used it, probably. Let's say that they wrote it in 1981, and ever since then, nobody had touched it. And it just evolved into Windows by sensing inputs from its environment. It's like, hey, there's a mouse hooked up to this computer. Maybe if I pick up the signals of the mouse, I could do something here. Hey, let's make a web browser. Hey, let's make Outlook. Hey, let's make a spreadsheet. What if Windows could do that and not need any external programmers? Would you be more impressed with Bill Gates than you are right now?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I looked at this and I said, if evolution is true, then the original program in the original cell would have had to be 10 gazillion times more ingenious than if, like, okay, we're going to make cells and we're going to make zebras, and we're going to make frogs, and we're going to make humans. If you had a program that could generate all the diversity of life and fill the earth with, you know, all these little niches with different kind of creatures, oh my goodness, that's amazing. Well, that's, I said if I'm going to believe in evolution, it raises my conception of God, not lowers it. Okay? And that's where I'm going with this. Another thing, mole rats, they have eyes under their skin. Okay? It's like a fully functioning eye, but it's covered with skin. Well, all it needs is something that can sense light and dark, but it has lenses and all this kind of stuff. Well, it makes sense to me that it came from some kind of an ancestor that used its eyes, but in this case, it made more sense for the eyes to be buried under the skin so it could go into the ground. Grasshopper wings, they don't really work quite right, but they're there. And so this convinced me beyond reasonable doubt that evolution is there. It's a hypothesis that says, well, now if I buy into an evolutionary point of view, I can ask the question, so how did God build life on Earth? I can ask that question. If God beamed zebras, you know, onto the savanna and they appeared Star Trek style, I can't investigate that. But if life evolved, I can investigate that. That means if evolution is true, I can learn more about God than if evolution is not true. Well, if I have a belief that God wants us to learn and study and make new discoveries, then that idea of God would be more open to evolution. If whales have these tiny feet that they don't need, that they hang on to, this to me is an engineering feature. It's like a software feature that's grayed out, and if you buy the little license, it turns on. Cool. That's very interesting. Okay, so here's the next thing. The atheist point of view is that if evolution is true, life is purposeless. Well, I've never seen a code that was purposeless. I can't think of any. As we go on with this presentation, I think you'll find that evolution is very purposeful. And it actually looks forward into the future and anticipates what the organism is going to need in the future. And so I would submit to you that this idea that, you know, if evolution is true, therefore life is accidental, life is purposeless, it does not logically follow. It's not a... What's that? Well, you'll find this in any atheist, you know, they'll say, evolution has no goals. We decide what our purposes are. There's no purposes built into nature. Richard Dawkins will tell you that, and P.Z. Myers will tell you that, and all those guys will tell you that. They'll say, hey, wake up. It's our job to decide what our purpose is. It's not part of nature. The other thing is, you know, I've never seen a computer program evolve all by itself. I've never seen DOS get better just because it was getting copied and passed around, and there was occasional copying errors, and occasionally the copies that got corrupted were better. I've never seen that. Nobody who has a communication engineer background would ever believe that.
It's the absence of nature.
So what I began to discover was there's one kind of version that the atheist guys and the biology and the like the freshman biology books talk about. There's a whole different version of evolution that you read about in PhD level scientific literature. And that really is true. The typical Richard Dawkins book is kind of a Dick and Jane story. It's very incomplete. It's very selective. Welcome. it's very selective about what it tells you, because there's things they don't want to tell you. So the Richard Dawkins version says mutations are the random changes in genes that constitute the raw material for evolution by non-random selection. Okay? So what he's saying is mutations are accidental. DNA gets miscopied, it gets corrupted, occasionally it's better. Natural selection picks out the winners. That is not true. Cells actually, one of the most interesting things I discovered very early on was, so I write this Ethernet book, right? And what I found out when I worked on this book was there's these layers and layers and layers of information. When you send an email, you know, from you to me, that message, it gets wrapped in a code, which gets wrapped in a code, which gets wrapped into a code, which gets wrapped into a code. There's layers and layers, and then it gets sent, and then it gets unwrapped layer by layer on the other side. And every one of those wrappers has error detection mechanisms. Every one of those wrappers has error correction mechanisms. And I found out that DNA has all those same things. Cells have this enormous amount of machinery that will not allow copying errors to go on. Cancer is when the copying error detection stops working. Okay, there's a kill switch that says, abort this cell, it's a mutant. Okay, so cells defend against this with unbelievable capability. Now, you find this in all kinds of literature. It's all over the place. The University of California, Berkeley website. If you go there, it says, mutations are random. The mechanisms of evolution, like natural selection and genetic drift, work with the random variation generated by mutation. Well, they're really big on this random idea. Okay? It's not true. So I found this chasm. And so I'm gonna talk about five evolutionary mechanisms as I explored. I said, okay, so if evolution is not random, how does it work? What makes it tick? If DOS can evolve into Windows Vista without any human programmers ever tampering with it, how does it do that? Man, if you could figure that out, you'd win 10 Nobel Prizes. Like, this is major. So I'm going to show you some really interesting things. This is commonly called a sea squirt, a little tubular creature. You see them in aquariums and stuff like that. They call it a tunicate. Well, there's another creature called a hagfish. And the difference between a tunicate and a hagfish is a hagfish is two segments of tunicate DNA. Okay, so you have a sea squirt, and it's got a strand of DNA that's this long. Yeah, and they're added together. And they're identical. They're nearly identical. Okay? So I've got this one strand of DNA, and then I got another one stitched right on the end of it, and some of the genes are switched on and off. And an invertebrate becomes a vertebrate. Maybe in a very small number of generations. So it doubles the hard drive space, rearranges some of the data, and you go from invertebrate to vertebrate. That's quite an engineering accomplishment. Probably the sea squirt was in a very hostile environment, and it starts mutating. And I'll talk about how organisms intentionally mutate their own DNA. It starts mutating, and it creates an adaptation where a hagfish can survive in an environment where a sea squirt cannot. And so now you have this branching of the evolutionary tree. So Darwin said that evolution was gradual. It's like, you know, just gradual. I'm saying to you, no, actually, sometimes it's very rapid. It's just like human technology. You've got CD players and smaller CD players and smaller CD players and more portable CD players, and then all of a sudden you have MP3 players, like out of nowhere. They took memory chips and different circuitry and they rearranged them and they made an MP3 player. It's a different animal than a CD player. It does the same thing, but it does it better, right? So you have this quantum leap. Well, same thing in nature. You have these quantum leaps. This is why the fossil record doesn't look the way Darwin thought it would. Because Darwin didn't have any idea that organisms had the ability to make these quantum leaps. But they do. Okay? Now, when you go from vertebrates, so a hagfish is a vertebrate without a jaw. Well, then you have vertebrates with jaws. And the difference between a hagfish and then the next kind of sea creature that has a jaw, it's another doubling again. So you double, you get a spine. You double again, you get a spine with a jaw. Okay? That's what the evolutionary tree really looks like. Now, I'm looking at this with my background and I'm going, that's an amazing piece of code. You know, I can't just double my, like, I get four DOSes, I don't get Windows. Right? And so in biology, this doubling, the name for this is polyploidy. This has been observed to create new species of plants. Wheat is polyploidy. Wheat has six genomes strung together. Evolutionary mechanism number two is transposition. This is a little picture of a gene, and there are different sections, and these yellow ones, these are called transposons, and these are sections of DNA that can be moved, so cells actually snip pieces of DNA and rearrange them and move them to other places. And so it's cut and paste, copy, twist it around, invert it and paste. There's a whole set of genetic engineering mechanisms that cells possess so they can make these changes. And so if you take bacteria, you put them in a petri dish, and you don't give them any food, and what you do is you put citrate in there, and citrate is a chemical that would be food if they knew how to digest it, but they don't know how to digest it. What will happen is they will start slicing their own DNA into thousands of pieces and rearranging it, and they will try to find a physiology that can digest the citrate. And eventually, some of those bacteria will succeed, and they will start digesting citrate, and they have now evolved the ability to digest a kind of food that wasn't there before. And none of this is random. This is software engineering of the highest order.
But still micro.
Right.
Still on a micro level of evolution.
This wasn't.
Yeah,
so some of
it's still a similar creature.
Okay, well, we could talk about that later. All right, so a protozoa under stress splices its own DNA into 100,000 pieces and rearranges the pieces. So a cell is a better programmer than a human. It's pretty amazing. Now, mechanism number three. Y'all know about antibiotics, right? You know you're not supposed to take too much of them because germs develop resistance to antibiotics, right? Well, has anybody ever told you how they do that? So let's say you're taking an antibiotic and you're trying to get rid of this germ. So these bacteria floating around in your system, and the bacteria says, man, this is killing me. I get this poison leaking into my cell wall. If I don't get rid of this poison, I'm dead. So that bacteria goes around through your system, and it looks for a cell that has a pump. And when it finds one, it grabs the DNA from a plasmid. A plasmid is like the open source code sharing repository of bacteria. Okay, they have this. They have, it's a little bundle of DNA that's publicly available, and they share data with each other. And so that bacteria grabs the plasmid of another cell that has a pump. It cuts out the section of DNA that codes for a pump. It inserts that code into its DNA. It reads it, it builds a pump, and it pumps the poison out. And then, when it works, it shares that code with all the other same species of bacteria in your system, and they all get better. So it's an arms race of them versus you. And your immune system does the exact same thing back. Now, how come nobody told you this? This is how nature really works. Okay?
There's beginning to be some science shows that are reiterating what you're saying.
Oh, actually, you know, there's 100 years of science that reinforces what I'm telling you. It's just that John Q. Public never hears about this.
Well, they never care enough to be interested and don't see it as anything that has to do with religion. And I think that's why organized religion has failed through the years, is because it doesn't take science seriously.
Well, yeah.
Hang on. The antiquated organized religions you write about.
Okay, hang on.
Okay, but not.
Okay, I mean.
You go to Answers in Genesis and Creation.com and
all. Hang on.
They are major scientists.
Okay, so.
And Dave Hunt's latest book also.
Okay, we'll to be continued. All right. This is a guy named Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. Brilliant researcher. He believed 200 years ago, he believed that that parents pass learned traits on to their offspring. And that was a popular idea for a while. And it felt like he believed that some of the things you learn can be passed to your children, or some of your adaptations.
Without ever learning them yourself, you have a propensity to learn something because your parents already knew it.
Maybe something, yeah. You know, that kind of idea. It was like, well, you know, maybe if I developed strong muscles, it would somehow give my kids strong muscles. Well, then Darwin came along, and his theory, you know, developed this wide following, and they laughed Lamarck out. They said, no, there is no inherited traits. It's just random mutation, natural selection, end of story. Darwin's right, Lamarck is wrong. 200 years later, we find out Lamarck is actually right. A good example of this is the Dutch famine of 1944. So winter of 1944, there's no food. Everybody's starving. Well, they have tracked babies that were conceived and carried to term during the Dutch famine, and their metabolism is different. Their parents passed on a tendency for their bodies to really conserve food. Audrey Hepburn, for example, has some disorders related to the fact that her mother conceived her during the Dutch famine. This is called epigenetics. Let me give you an idea how it actually works. I found my thing. It was under my napkin, by the way. So I have a sentence here. Flight 6429 was delayed from Chicago to Winnipeg, so it will not be departing before 6:45 p.m. I can gray out some of these letters without deleting them, And if I just look at the black ones, it says flight 29 to Winnipeg will depart before 6. And now the sentence says something completely different without deleting text, right? Okay. Epigenetics is a mechanism where DNA is covered with a sheath where it is not read by the hard drive, if you will. And it causes, it's like putting a template over a piece of information to make it express itself in a different way than it did before. Okay? This is what is passed on from parents to children. I suspect that it's a mechanism like this, which is how birds have learned to fly south in the winter and end up at the same place every single time. That there's multiple repetitions of this editing, and it's not that the DNA has been deleted or the genes are gone. It's that they're silenced. Epigenetics is one of the functions that makes eye cells in your eyes be built differently than cells in your kidneys or your liver or your stomach. It's that when, as the cells differentiate, the epigenetic templates start blocking different kinds of genes so that they're only selectively reading it. Oh, we need to build an eye cell. So you have an eye template over a strand of DNA and you have your eyes. You have a liver template over a strand of DNA and you have your liver. So, but it's all your DNA in all those cells. And that's epigenetics. So epigenetics is a major component of how species evolve, because not only does the expression of cells get tweaked by this mechanism, but environmental factors can change those templates. I don't know exactly how this is done. I don't know how cells know what they're supposed to do, but this is what they do.
Gene expression, you don't have to have diabetes.
Yes, right.
So you have the positive also effect.
Yeah, yeah. So the fifth mechanism of evolution is called symbiogenesis. And symbiogenesis is when two creatures merge to form one creature. The best example of symbiogenesis I can give you is lichen. So we all know what lichen is, right? It's that green flaky stuff we see on rocks. Lichen is algae plus fungus. It's algae and fungus in a completely intertwined relationship where, for all intents and purposes, they reproduce as a single organism. There are lots of symbiotic mergers in history. This is a completely different species. A lot of scientists believe that complex cells are a merger of two simple cells because all the parts are the same and the DNA tells that story.
Is there such a thing still as a simple cell?
Well, I mean relatively. I don't mean it insultingly. I mean the relatively simple cells and the relatively complex cells are actually combinations of the simpler versions.
Does the new creature it forms have equal of both sides, or does it, or is one side more dominant?
This is still assumption, though. I mean, it's two similar organisms, but we don't know that the actual merging of those two created that, or if that was originally like that when it first came to be.
You
just happen to have properties.
You're welcome to be skeptical. And
well,
I'm not.
You don't have proof of that. That's how that actually formed, right?
No, we have inference.
Right.
We have right. Tracks. Okay. So I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer your question. But to a little perspective, 90% of the cells in your body are bacteria that are friendly to you. Like the tiny little bacteria in your digestive system are in a symbiotic relationship with you. So it's very, very interesting. All right. I have never found a single research paper that demonstrated that the path from one species to another was random. And, you know, I get the debates and conversations with people on my website and everything. I say, prove to me that the path between one species and another is random. What the DNA says is the path is modular. It's like the Winnipeg sentence. You have these wholesale changes of, okay, we shut off these genes, we turn on these other genes, and we get a dramatic change, not just a tiny little tweak. Not that there aren't tiny little tweaks, there are lots of them. But you can't get from a cell to a giraffe in tiny little tweaks. Just like you don't get from CD players to MP3 players with tiny little tweaks. At some point, there's a complete jump where you've gotten rid of something entirely and you've added something else. And so, what I'm finding in the literature is there's a version of science that is said to be random, but it really isn't, and it's philosophically driven. Lynn Margulis used to be married to Carl Sagan. She's a very respected biologist at Amherst. She said mutation accumulation does not lead to new species or even new organs or tissues. Even professional evolutionary biologists are hard put to find mutations, experimentally induced or spontaneous, that lead in a positive way to evolutionary change. She's saying this random mutation theory doesn't have any support, and it doesn't. It's stated in 1,000 biology books, but you can't find any papers that prove it. Mathematically, it's not possible to prove randomness. That's part of the problem. You can prove non-randomness, but you can't prove randomness. I would submit to you that science always prefers non-randomness to randomness. Because as soon as you say something's random, there's nothing more to investigate. You're done.
You also would be left if it was true with a lot of useless creatures.
Right.
Because a creature changes to either for survival or because environment needs it or he needs that environment.
Right. That's correct. So I believe that the random mutation theory in biology is the biggest mistake in the history of science. It has led us down all kinds of blind alleys. I'll give you a couple examples. There's been a theory called junk DNA. It started about 30 years ago, and it's finally starting to get thrown out. Okay? But for 30 years, there was a whole bunch of people that said 97% of your DNA is junk. Well, those were biologists that were not doing their jobs. Their job is to find out what the 97% they don't understand actually does. A creationist, even the most naive, simplistic creationist, would never say anything like that. Why? Because they have too much respect for nature to ever believe that. A scientist's job is to respect nature, and it's to assume order until absolutely proven otherwise. That's the scientist's job. These guys have not been doing their jobs. So what I have seen is that evolution is intentional. It's like this, that bacteria is deliberate. It is looking for something that will fight that antibiotic. And it hunts until it either dies or finds it. That's intentional. It's teleological. It's systematic. It follows rules. By the way, you take a whole bunch of petri dishes of bacteria and you starve them and you do the citrate thing. a lot of them will find very similar paths to that problem. It's like solving a math problem where there's only like three correct answers. There's not 9 million correct answers, there's just a few. It's very sophisticated. It's way more sophisticated than anything that we have in computer science. And it's a design feature. I think that's the best way to understand evolution. The biology profession is really searching for an answer to the evolutionary problem. So you remember what I said earlier about, there's like the Dick and Jane version of evolution, and then there's like the real one. Well, the real one is very fragmented. You get into the literature, there's all kinds of ideas of it might work this way, it might work like this, it might work like this, it might work like this. And a lot of these guys, they don't really want John Q. Public to know how much they disagree and throw chairs at each other behind closed doors. Okay? But it's true. This is a really interesting book. It's called The Altenburg 16, An Exposé of the Evolution Industry by Susan Mazur. This is not even remotely a religious book. But it's a series of interviews with all these different biologists about, how do you think we're going to figure this out? And what do you think the solution is? And you just get this huge range of different opinions. It's very fragmented right now. But the evolution profession is really searching for something right now. The wrong question is creation versus evolution. I think it is a totally wrong-headed question to be asking in the first place. I think the right question is naturalism or design. Are you here and you here? Are we here because of something purposeful, or are we here because of something purposeless? And I submit to you that a purposeful assumption is scientific, and an unpurposeful assumption is anti-scientific. If you deny purpose in evolution, you'll always end up with a wrong answer, because you end up not exploring something that you really should have explored. I think Christians and atheists are equally guilty for the current state of affairs, where you got, the zealots screaming at each other. But I hold the Christians more responsible. And here's why. Science was born in Christian Western Europe. Amen. Because of theological assumptions that did not exist in any of the other cultures. Okay? So science got started in Greece and Rome, and it sputtered out. It got started in China. It got started in Islam. It got started in Egypt. It got started in India. In all those places, it kind of went so far, and then it sputtered and died. But in Europe, it took off like a rocket. Why? Well, here's why I believe that happened. Christian theology teaches that the world obeys fixed, discoverable laws. The Wisdom of Solomon, which is in the Apocrypha, says, "Thou hast ordered everything in weight and number and measure." Only Christian theology had that belief. You go to the Greeks and the Romans, they had beliefs. There's all these gods and they're fighting with each other and they do all these things, and how could you possibly figure out what they're going to do next? You couldn't build a naturalistic scientific platform on that kind of a belief about God. Okay? So fast forward, Darwin comes along and he says, hey, I think all these creatures came from a similar spot, from a single lineage, and he jumped to the conclusion, therefore there's no purpose, therefore, and Christians circled the wagons. they said, no, 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 no. That's bad, bad, bad. You have to read the Bible this way, or you're a heretic. Okay, I've gotten a lot of that. Perry, if you don't read it, if you think day is anything but, you know, 24 hours, you're violating God's holy word. Well, you know, if you want to debate textual interpretation, we can go out to dinner and we can do that. All right? But you know, you get into rigid interpretations of things, you always end up stumbling somewhere. Okay? And so you end up with this prejudice. It's just like any other, whether it's Jews and Arabs or, you know, whatever kind of, it's like, those guys are bad, you know. Those guys are evil. It's like, well, no, they're... Right, and you just get this thing, okay? I think if you're a Christian, you should love science and you should be willing to take it wherever it takes you. And you should not be afraid of it. And I think there's been a lot of fear of science. And yeah, there's... I mean, as I've watched all these debates, I'm just really struck at how similar the two sides are to each other. You know, it's like they're just saying opposite things, but they both act the exact same way. And I think, I believe the truth is in the middle. And I believe that what Augustine said, God wrote two books. He wrote this book of Scripture and the book of Nature, and both of them are telling the truth. And so we have to just patiently walk through that. So my contention is evolution is design. Evolution requires design. Everything that evolves only evolves because it's designed. Things don't evolve by random accident. So I want you to just consider. I got about 2 minutes here, and then I'll be done, and I will have done my hour. I want you to notice a couple things. And God said, "Let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants, and trees in the land that bear fruit with seeds in it, according to their various kinds." And it was so. Now, when you read that, where's the problem with evolution?
Kinds.
Okay, so kinds only means...
No, it means that things within their kind. A fruit produces fruit.
Right.
A bird produces a bird. A tree produces a tree, and so on and so on. Well, that's silly. Fruit trees, the same. I used a similar example there.
It is a vague word.
It is a vague word, but if you read beyond that, contextually,
okay,
you'll see that he addresses other creatures and says of their kind. So I'm not here to argue it. I'm just pointing out the question was asked, what do I see in kinds?
Well,
I'm a context person. To me, it's not so much what's being said, but often what is not being said.
Right.
There's more to the story here than what just this is. There's geology.
Well, okay.
There's space.
So. I'm willing to consider what the word kind might mean. And here's the thing. If Christianity does not forbid a person to believe in evolution, but you know what? Atheism sure does forbid people to believe in design. As C.S. Lewis said, if you're an atheist, you better be darn careful what you read.
Are you ready to believe anything? Because you're ready to believe anything. That's what he said, yeah.
Well, actually, he meant because you might find some evidence that doesn't really fit. Right. Or this verse. So God created great creatures of the sea and every living moving thing with the water teams according to their kinds.
According to their kinds.
Right.
And what version is that, too?
Oh, I don't know. And every winged bird according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. I see room for a tree of life in this. Now, last couple slides here. Oh, well, okay. Paul, you're dangerous. Okay. And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living soul.
What is another word for the breath of life?
Spirit. Yes. Okay. This is not oxygen. You can go to 500-year-old commentaries. This is not talking about oxygen. This is talking about what makes humans human. That humans have something very special. Now, so if God breathed into a primate-like creature a soul, that creature is now completely different from an animal. So if you believe that the Son of God could be fully man and fully God because he had a different kind of spirit than the rest of us, then it's no different to believe that the difference between an animal and a human is likewise a spirit. And so...
Could the spirit be just the highest form of DNA?
A Christian theologian that
is just a little bit higher than anything else in any other animal? That
you would be...
Necessity to control an unchanged earth?
You'd be hard-pressed to find a theologian who would agree that that difference is purely physical. So, anyway. Last slide. It is the glory of God to conceal a matter. To search out a matter is the glory of kings. Okay? I believe that the world is wrapped in mystery. I believe that if you think they had it all figured out at the Protestant Reformation, you might need to rethink that. I'm not putting any particular person down, by the way. I'm just saying, you know, we're all learning, we're all advancing, and the truth is much more subtle than the black and white people over here and the black and white people over here would like you to believe. And there's something very wonderful and mystical here. And I just invite y'all to embrace it. So what I'd like to do is take about 6 or 7 minutes, do some Q&A, and then we'll go to Richard because I'm running late. So, yes? Yeah. Well, my brother, about a year ago, he went with some friends of mine to their church in Texas. And he says to me, we're riding in the car, and he goes, you know what? He said, I had to be honest and admit to myself, I really liked being in a community of people who were worshiping. Now, it didn't mean he had it all figured out. And it didn't mean that he was going to, you know, wave the flag and, you know, all that. But he also thanked me several years ago. He says, Perry, I have to thank you for keeping me from becoming an atheist. You know, those guys are just another set of fundamentalists, you know. It's like, well, you know, you were one and then you almost turned into the other. I'm glad you, you know, kind of grew up. And it was... He had to grow up. And I don't mean that in any put down. We all have to grow up. And he had this very kind of simplified, brittle view of the world. And a point came where it kind of shattered. It was like, well, you know, maybe there's more smart people in the world than just my seminary professors. You know, maybe there's a lot of things. Maybe there's a lot of smart people out there that I could be listening to. And so he's not, like, landed, but... He's really interested to see how this project has gone. He's watching. So, yes, sir?
So, how old do you think man is?
Man with soul or man physically?
Okay, well, there's God's version he created. Let's forget the 6 days now prior to creation.
Mm-hmm.
And there's science that says man goes back. Population mathematics, or what do you call that?
Right, genetics.
Not genetics, you know, that complex math.
Well, so here's, you're kind of getting outside of my knowledge area,
but here's what I think. What I'm trying to do, I'm trying to create another context of environment, because I've been studying what you're talking about for many, and I was introduced to you a long time ago, so I'm very familiar with what you're doing. Okay, but I've taken mine in the 30 years that I've been doing this, and I've learned that I have to stretch this out to a greater amount of studies and fields of sciences.
Okay, so get to the question.
Find them all. So exactly. So based on your belief, man is how old, and was there then death before Adam and Eve, according to you.
Oh, death in, on earth absolutely existed
so
before
Adam
then.
Adam and Eve is an allegory or a fact?
In the day that you eat this fruit, you will surely die. Did she die that day?
Doesn't matter whether she died that day.
Okay. Next question.
Is there room in your model for randomness to be used purposefully?
For randomness to be used purposefully? I accept the possibility that it could be, but you would never be able to figure it out. Like, you know, so is God operating in the randomness?
That kind of seems a little contradictory. Well, isn't the immune system an example of a process that uses randomness?
You have like these hair-splitting differences of definitions of randomness, actually. And so, boy, that's like a half an hour answer. But I'm open to the possibility. Let me quickly address your question, okay? If you insist that I take this word literally, I'm going to insist that you take every other word literally. We can talk about it later, but short answer to your question. I think what we see in anthropology is that at some point in time, I don't know, 10,000 years ago or something, there was this sudden explosion of cultural and religious stuff that just like, it was like a sort of a big bang. And it's unprecedented. And prior to that, you have human-like creatures that don't quite seem to be human. And so that I see, you know, God breathed the breath of life into the man, he became a living being. That's what I see that meaning.
But it's not right for you then to perceive that because on this day you shall die, as you even speak of evolution as being, especially on the macro level, because
that's spiritual death. It's spiritual death. Romans 5.
Well, wait a minute. It's more than that because God created them perfect.
It doesn't say that.
Yes, it does.
No, it doesn't. Where's the word perfect in Genesis 1 or 2?
It was good.
Yeah, that's it. It was good. Yeah, death.
Is God perfect? Or is he imperfect?
God is perfect.
Okay,
the world
so
is good.
If a perfect God, I'm not trying to debate, I'm just trying to get to a position. If God, and I'm not debating here, let me ask my question and get a freaking answer.
Okay.
Okay, if God is perfect and God says, this is good. The perfect God says, this is good. Now here's context. Okay,
right.
This is the kind of context I'm talking about. You're taking a single word, it is good, and you're isolating it from everything else.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are. I would argue that you are.
But you're not debating.
We have to bring this into context.
All right. Thank you.